Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this: you're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
But when it comes to this particular topic, that technology is addictive and hijacking our brains, it's rubbish. It's promoted by people who have an agenda. It's promoted by publications, ironically enough, who are making money the same exact way that these companies do, selling attention. Right? These are attention merchants, just like Facebook and YouTube, the New York Times, or a publication online also sells eyeballs. And guess what? Fear sells. And it's nothing new. It's a tried and true tactic to get attention, to tell you that technology is melting your brain. Today, it's Facebook and video games. Uh-huh. Before that, it was television. Before that, it was comic books, the pinball machine, the novel, the written word, for God's sakes. All of these things were supposed to melt our minds. And literally, Socrates says that the written word will enfeeble men's minds. But you know what? The human species adapts and adopts. I am very optimistic when it comes to our future, if we know what to do. I will admit, I will definitely concede that if you don't know what to do in this day and age, they're going to get you. No doubt about it. They understand what makes you click and what makes you tick better than you understand yourself. But the antidote to impulsiveness, the antidote to all of these addictive and hijacking algorithms that are going to make you do all this terrible stuff, the antidote to impulsiveness is forethought. If you know what to do, you are way more powerful than these companies will ever be.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Nir, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So you have a new book out called Indistractable, How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life, a subject that everybody who is listening knows that I am incredibly passionate about because it's something I've struggled with my whole life. But before we get into all of that, I want to ask you something that I think is always interesting to learn from people who are immigrants or children of immigrants, and that is, what did your parents do for a living, and how did that influence and shape what you've decided to do with your life?
Yeah, that is actually a terrific question because it is being an immigrant to this country, especially when you get stuck with a weird name like I have, and no offense, you also have an unusual name for the typical American. I grew up in Orlando, Florida, right? People had no idea what to make of me at all. And I left Israel when I was 3 years old. So my parents, my father started a spark plug business, made a little money on that. And then that's what funded his trip to America to pursue the American dream. And then he started a business in the pool supply industry. And my mom was an art teacher in Israel. And then when she came to America, her English wasn't good enough to continue being a teacher. So she was a homemaker.
Yeah. So based on their experience, what advice did they give you growing up as when you're a kid? Like, is it like a typical sort of Indian, Asian immigrant things like become a doctor or engineer, we'll disown you?
That's certainly the Jewish guilt is in full effect in my family. And so I'm sure there's analogs. And my wife happens to be a first generation American of Chinese descent. And it's interesting because I always thought I'd marry a Jewish girl. And yet I found so much more in common with a first generation immigrant who happens to be from China, because we have such a similar mentality in terms of work ethic and our relationship with material possessions and a lot of, and a big part of familial obligation of coming and pursuing the American dream. And so, I don't think it was so much, I hear from other folks how there is this mentality of, if you're not a lawyer or a doctor, then you're a failure. But I don't know if that was in full effect in my household. But we definitely did have an ethic of aspiring for some kind of entrepreneurship. There's a term in Yiddish that is called being a putz. A putz is like a sucker. And you don't want to be the putz. And so part of why my father was so entrepreneurial is that he didn't want to have to rely on someone else to feed him for his daily bread. Yeah. He wanted to be an entrepreneur. And I think that is something that I definitely took as a value from my parents.
It's funny because Jerry Colonna said virtually the exact same thing in just different words. I just finished talking to him. So I think there's something about this that draws those of us who don't fit into normal systems into this kind of stuff. But we'll get to your career and what's led up to this point. You mentioned your wife is Chinese. Mm-hmm. And I know that you make references to your kids and all that in the book. And we'll talk a little bit about, dealing with that from a digital standpoint. But what I wonder is, from a cultural standpoint, you've got two different cultures coming together.
How do you integrate the two cultures, and how do you pass on what's important to you to your kids? Because, you know, I always think to myself, if I don't marry an Indian girl, the first thing that's going to go is language. And I'm 100% sure of that. And, you know, I mean, I see it a little bit with my sister already, because her husband is Bengali and, you know, we're from South India. And I'm like, oh, wow. Like, I mean, she's picking up little bits of Bengali here and there. But I wonder, I was like, huh, like, I wonder, is she going to teach her kids our language? Are they going to teach their kids Bengali, or are neither of those things going to get passed on?
Yeah. Wow. This is a great topic. I have to admit, I didn't expect to talk about this. I think it's fascinating. I'm glad we're going here. But I'll tell you, it's always tricky to talk about this stuff from a generalizations point of view. So let me just say that everything I'm saying right now has nothing to do with how I think anyone else should live. Okay. This is completely autobiographical. I'm not giving anyone advice. I'll give you advice on how to be indistractable. I'll give you advice on how to build habit forming products. That's what I write books about. Yeah. But when it comes to this particular topic of integrating cultures and raising your kids in a culturally informed way, this is just totally autobiographical. And so in my relationship with my wife, and we've been married about 20 years now, almost coming up on 20 years now. So we've really grown up together. I mean, we met when we were 18 years old, and it was a big issue for us because, you know, a lot of Jewish people, especially those that come from Israel, my great grandparents were essentially kicked out of Europe, and my grandparents came to Israel as children and helped found the country. I mean, they were there before 1948, before the founding of the country, and so there's a very strong guilt trip, I would say, that goes from one generation to the next around how important it is to marry inside the religion. And I can't write either. You know, there's the whole Holocaust thing that no one can escape from. It's very palpable in at least in my household it was. And so it was just always like it was just assumed that I would marry a Jewish girl. And of course, nothing wrong with Jewish girls. I didn't, you know, avoid them in any way. I just happened to fall in love with a girl who wasn't Jewish. And personally, like while the culture is very significant, it's the way I grew up. I don't necessarily subscribe to the supernatural aspects of Judaism. That doesn't speak to me. And so when Julie and I met, and I knew that this was the girl that I wanted to be with for the rest of my life. This was a really big issue. In fact, we broke up for a while because I hadn't reconciled how I could, have a life with this person I wanted to live with, and who I loved more than anybody else I'd ever met. And yet I'd have to give up what seemed to be my culture, my identity. And so at first we tried the whole conversion route. Julie was such a great sport. She went through the whole conversion process, to try and make that work out. And it didn't work out for us. We couldn't get past the supernatural stuff that, one day she, at the end of the class, she turned to me and said, "Okay, I've taken the class. You tell me, do you believe this stuff? Like, do you actually think this stuff really happened?" I said, "No, I'm sorry. I don't. You're right. So why am I asking you to convert when I don't, you know, you have to tell the rabbis you believe." And I couldn't tell the rabbis that, and I couldn't ask her to do it either. And so she came up with a really fantastic insight, which was that religions evolve. They've always evolved. Nobody has a monopoly on any one religion. The Orthodox Jews don't own it. It's always changed. The Judaism or Hinduism or Christianity, every one of them was different 100 years ago, certainly 1,000 years ago. So they continue to evolve. And so we found a denomination of Judaism called secular humanism that doesn't require you to believe in anything supernatural, but still preserves the culture. And so that's how we raise my daughter, to answer your question. We are grounded in the traditions of Judaism, but if she wants to believe or not to believe in any of the supernatural stuff that is involved in the stories, that's her prerogative. We don't make her say things that she doesn't believe, which was not the case in my family. We had to say the prayers exactly as they were written, whether we believed them or not. So we don't make my daughter do that. And the good thing is that's, to me, I've now come to realize, and thanks to Julie to getting me here, is that this is what all religions have always done. They have always evolved to their environments. And so we are Americans first. I mean, we are really proud Americans. I love this country so much, and I'm a naturalized citizen. I love its ideals. I love what it stands for. We got lots of problems, certainly, but I think we're Americans first. But we are our household is rooted in the ethics of the Judeo-Christian or the Judeo history and the people of Judaism more than necessarily a supernatural being.
Yeah. It's funny because I think that for me, the first thing to go would be religion. And, you know, I've always said my primary gripe with religion, particularly because we're Indian, is that it's time consuming, especially if you're Indian. Like, it's incredibly time consuming. Just go to an Indian wedding and you'll see this. But yeah, it's one of those things I am always curious about with immigrants and in terms of how that plays out. So, you know, what in the world led you to the work that you do? I do have a funny way that I want to get to this book in particular, but what's been the path that led you to doing books and everything else that you're doing?
Well, before we get to that, though, I'm so curious about how you're thinking about it. Can we spend a few minutes?
Yeah, please,
I would love to hear how you have sorted this out for yourself. You're not married yet? Or
no,
ever?
I'm not married.
That's okay, too.
Yeah, no, I haven't been married. And so that's kind of one of those things where, so in my mind, I've kind of accepted that, okay, you know what? If I don't marry an Indian girl, a lot of this is going to go. Like, it's inevitable. Mm-hmm. There are some funny things that I think about, right? Because if, you know, like, so for example, and there's this really interesting scene in the movie, The Namesake, and the book is 1,000 times better. I don't know if you've ever read it or heard it, but I think it...
No, I saw the movie. I didn't read it.
Yeah. So Jhumpa Lahiri, the book is 1,000 times better, mainly because when you read the book for the first time and you've seen Harold and Kumar go to White Castle, you kind of picture a very different Gogol than Cal Penn. And so he's kind of this odd character. But there's one scene in particular where he brings one of his girlfriends home, and she's a white girl. And, you know, he warns her beforehand, no kissing, no touching, like all this other stuff. And, you know, it was funny because, you know, when my sister brought her now husband home for the first time, it was pretty obvious that he would sleep in another room and she would sleep in another room. It was like, you know, that's just what we do. Mm-hmm. And I always wondered in my mind, I was like, I'm like, if I brought a girl who wasn't Indian to the house, she would probably be like, what the hell? Why are you not staying in the same room as me? And one of my friends from college actually decided to use me as his test case with his own parents for this. He put me and a girlfriend in a bedroom when we were going to a friend's wedding, and he's like, yeah, my parents don't like you. And I'm like, why? He's like, because you slept in the same room as your girlfriend at their house. I was like, you put us there. And the funny thing is, the night, you know, prior, another friend got so drunk that he hit his head on the cement. We had to go like get stitches in his head at the hospital. They're all like, they love him.
Oh, man.
Which, so it's funny because these are the sort of, you know, we're kind of thinking out loud about this, but, you know, those are the things that I think about is, you know, what are those subtle nuances going to be like that anybody who was your same ethnicity would just be like, oh yeah, I get it.
Yeah. By the way, speaking of, I get it. This happened to me when I first visited Julie's parents. This is exactly the circumstance. I had to sleep outside. I couldn't sleep in her room when I visited her parents' house. The funny thing is, and this might be, again, this is, you know, all advice is autobiographical. So I will say this might just be something that happened in our family, but you know, we did it for a few nights. I slept on the couch outside in the living room. But then after a few nights, it was like, come on, who are we kidding? Right? Like, her parents. And so maybe the fear that we have of what our parents might think, what they might do, how they might behave, maybe it's a little bit overblown because, you know, we talked about this at length before I actually visited. But then when it actually came down to it, you know, we respected their rules. It was under their roof. We did what they said. Yeah. But even they, after a few nights, were like, okay, whatever. Like, who are we kidding? We know what you guys do when you're off at college, right? Like, so who are we kidding? And some of that is that, you know, the realities of coming to America, we have to remember that was their choice. Yeah. We came here as, I don't know about when you came to America. It sounds like you've been here a very long time based on your accent.
So we left, my parents left India in 1978, but it was like Australia, Canada, then Texas. And we landed here in 1986.
So you were a kid. It wasn't your choice to come here. It wasn't my choice to come here. It wasn't my wife's choice to be born here. That's a choice immigrants make. That's the price you pay for the American dream. And that's, and we don't often talk about that. We think about that as children of immigrants, as like what we are doing to our parents. Remember, our parents did this to us. And for me personally, you laugh because you say, oh, but they've given us so much. Like, thank goodness for the American dream. Yes, but everything comes at a price. Nothing is for free. The price of pursuing the American dream is that you give up your heritage in the way it was defined for you before you came. You will not be the same person that you would have been had you been born in India. I would not, or stayed in India, I should say. I would not be the same person by far if my parents had never left Israel. I would be a completely different person. That's the price you pay. as an immigrant. And that's yeah. part of this whole equation. And then the last thing I would say too is that remember, for all the worry we put our parents through and cultural, you know, changing and evolving a culture and marrying someone outside our heritage, there's always worse we have to compare to. So, for example, my oldest brother is gay. Uh-huh. And he came out back in 1989. And I remember this because back then, on the news, they called AIDS gay cancer.
Wow.
It wasn't even widely accepted that AIDS was associated with HIV. This was very early days. Being gay was very different than it is today. And so, you know, this was a crisis in my family when my brother came out. Now, of course, my parents love him. He has a boyfriend. They're so happy for him. And the fact that his boyfriend is not Jewish is like on nobody's radar. They're just happy he met somebody that he can enjoy his life with.
Yeah.
So we have to keep things in perspective, too, that what parents ultimately, I think, across the board really want for their children is that their children are happy.
Yeah. So speaking of the American dream, what was yours, you know, like college up until writing books and everything that you're doing? Like how did you get here?
Yeah. So my path, let's see. So I went to undergrad, met my future wife. I went off to consulting. I worked at BCG for several years. She worked as a banker at JPMorgan Chase. And we did those two professions for a while and got really tired of them. It was very hard, very, very hard work. And I'd always wanted to do something entrepreneurial. And the first chance we got, we started a business together. This was in the solar energy business back when the United States was entering the second Iraq war. And we had some premonition that oil prices would spike. This might be a good time to be an alternative energy. And we essentially set up what Solar City does today, very early days. So this was back in 2003. We set this up. And so we basically professionalized what at the time, there were no solar subsidies. We professionalized this company, ran that for a few years. We got an offer by a private equity firm to buy us out. And that kind of put us on our feet. And then I applied to one school for business school, went to Stanford for business school. If it had not gotten into Stanford, we would have just kept running the business. But that was an opportunity that at the time was too good for me to pass up because I was reading in the Wall Street Journal about this company, Facebook and Google, and these people who were somehow delivering their products online. And I was just so infatuated with how could they, you know, make a business by delivering bits as opposed to atoms, right? I was running this huge warehouse with a crew and inventory and cost of goods sold and all this stuff. And I just thought, oh my God, wouldn't it be amazing if you could just write code? That'd be so much cooler. And so the entree into that world was going to Stanford. I didn't even know what a venture capitalist was when I got to Stanford. I remember asking my friend, like, what exactly is this? Everybody keeps saying venture capitalist. What does that mean? So went to business school, started another company with my wife and two other co-founders. That company was in the intersection of gaming and advertising. And it was, we started in 2007, back when apps, when you said the word apps, you didn't mean mobile apps. You didn't mean apps on your phone like we do today because the Apple App Store didn't exist yet. It wasn't out until 2008. Apps back then meant Facebook apps. And so we were in the virtual goods business back when people thought that was a crazy, like, what the heck are virtual goods? But today, of course, selling virtual goods is a multi-billion dollar global industry. But we got started in that field pretty early on in 2007. By 2012, that company was acquired. And then 2012, I kind of stopped and said to myself, well, what do I want to do next? And I had this thesis around the importance of habit-forming products, that I had a belief that the products that would be the most important, the ones that would capture markets and have a competitive advantage, would be the ones who could create consumer habits. Because I could see what was going on. We were going from desktops to laptops to mobile devices to wearable devices. And today we have these auditory devices like Amazon Alexa, et cetera. The interface has shrunk. And I could see this happening. And I realized that as the interface shrinks, the amount of real estate we have to trigger people, to send them a message, to get them to do stuff, decreases. So it becomes increasingly important for us to engage them with a habit, with something that they do on their own, with unprompted user engagement, as opposed to constantly having to send them pings and dings and rings. And that's exactly what we see today, right? If you are not on someone's home screen, if you're on, you know, page three or four of their of their apps, you might as well not even exist. They don't remember you even exist. And so you have to have your product used habitually, or your business is really going to suffer. So I said, okay, that's my investment thesis. That's what I'm going to figure out what I'm going to do next with allocating my human capital. I wanted to start a habit-forming product of some kind, but I had no filter to understand what type of products require a habit and then how to build a habit-forming product. And so I looked and looked and looked, couldn't find a book on it, and said, well, I guess I'm going to have to write that book. I didn't intend to write the book. I intended to just, you know, read everything I could about the topic. And you know, I started blogging about it at nearandfar.com, and turns out a lot of other people were interested in this topic as well. I was very fortunate. My timing was really good. I had a lot of friends at these companies, like Facebook Twitter and Uber, these companies that were, you know, had designed their products and services using consumer psychology. So I kind of had a front row seat to talk to a lot of these folks. And of course, my contacts from my last business.
Right.
And so one day I got an email from a professor of mine, a former professor of mine, Baba Shiv at Stanford. And he said, look, I really like your stuff. Let's teach a class together. And so he was really generous and kind of gave me carte blanche to design a class around behavioral design. And so I taught that with him for several years. Then I moved over to the design school at Stanford. That kind of, you know, teaching there helped me organize the different parts of the book into a methodology that then we published the book in 2014. So we're just coming up on the 5-year anniversary. And shortly after publishing Hooked, I started thinking about this other problem that I was having, no longer the problem of how to build habit-forming products, but how to put distraction in its place. And so for the next 5 years, I've been working on Indistractable.
Okay, so I want to talk about that because I thought that was like a really interesting transition. And so this is, you know, as I was thinking about this, this is like the metaphor that came to my mind. Have you ever been to Costa Rica?
No.
Okay, so in Costa Rica, the roads are really bad. Like they're really shitty. And what's funny is there will literally be a pothole somewhere, and 100 yards down the road from where that pothole is a guy who fixes tires. And I feel like that's effectively what you've done here. Like you gave us Hooked, which is, hey, I created the pothole, and by the way, here's how you fix the tire with Indistractable. That was the thing that made me think, and it's such an interesting transition. But I want to kind of go back to some of what has happened as a byproduct.
But can I take issue with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that would be true if I caused the potholes.
That's what I was going to ask you is, you know, how much of Hooked was based on what had already happened, but how much has happened because of Hooked?
Yeah. So, you know, we got to remember too, that the vast majority of products out there are not addicting or even habituating anybody, right? People who have built product know how hard it is to get people to change behavior, right? If you've been in the trenches and you've built an app or built a website, consumer behavior, getting people to do what you want them to do is really hard. You know, the vast majority of products we use, think about, you know, interacting with your local business, your local government, enterprise software. These products don't suck us in, not the way that Facebook and YouTube and Instagram do. No, they don't suck us in. They just suck. Mm-hmm. And so the real goal of Hooked was to democratize these techniques. Yeah. So the people who use Hooked, it's not the gaming companies. It's not even Facebook or YouTube. They've known these techniques for years. Yeah. The people who use Hooked are the people who are using it to build healthy habits in users' lives. Yeah. That's who built. I mean, the case study, for God's sakes, the case study in Hooked in the first edition is the Bible. The Bible app is the case study. And the reason I put the Bible app in there, one, it's probably the most overlooked app out there. I mean, the engagement rate on this app is through the roof. It's still one of the most popular apps in the world. Hundreds of millions of people use this app. And they use the Hook model. They didn't know they were using it, but the more I analyzed it, I mean, that's part of how I came to understand the Hook model. I took Facebook and YouTube and Instagram and all this Slack and all these products and tried to figure out what they have in common and the Bible app. And that's how I started to understand these four key steps in the Hook model. Now, what you think about the Bible app is really telling in terms of whether you think I was helping to create potholes or not. Some right. people, when I tell them, oh, I help, you know, the Bible app, in fact, uses this methodology. They think that's wonderful because religion helps people find meaning in their life. It helps them build community. It helps them live out their values. It's a wonderful thing. But if you're the kind of person who says, actually, organized religion is terrible and it caused conflicts and division, then you're going to hate the Bible app.
Right.
And you know what? The same metaphor carries over to all sorts of things. So, you know, Facebook, for example, a lot of people get a lot of benefit out of Facebook. Some people sometimes go overboard on Facebook. What I want to steer clear of is this binary thinking that I think is way too pervasive in this world. Good versus evil. That's not the real world. In any topic, the answer to most problems in life is, it depends. It depends. Right. Is Facebook bad for you? It depends. How you use it, when you use it, who's using it. And so it's not quite so black and white. And that's really what Indistractable, where that leaves on, or where that leads into Indistractable, is that I wanted to give folks a toolkit for how to make sure that we can get the best out of technology without letting it get the best of us.
Yeah. So, you know, what I wonder is then when you hear about people like Cal Newport, who are huge advocates of what he calls digital minimalism, you know, can point to like one sort of study after another. And he even said, he says that, you know, you could get the benefits of using this thing without necessarily being addicted to it. But he said that's really hard to do simply because of the way that these products are designed. So the question is, and he said, and the problem is, he says that if you change the addictive design of it, it'll be detrimental to the bottom line of many of these companies. So when you hear the sort of Cal Newport argument, what is your sort of response to that, I wonder?
Yeah. So first of all, you know, people can disagree without being disagreeable. So I have a lot of respect for Cal. He blurbed my book. Mm-hmm. I did not blurb his.
Interesting.
And I didn't blurb his because he doesn't understand what addiction is and is not. Addiction is this word that we use so much today that it has become essentially meaningless. Addiction does not mean I like to use something a lot. Addiction does not even mean I overuse things a lot. Addiction means that you have a persistent compulsive dependency on a behavior or substance that harms the user. It is a pathology. The words we use matter a lot. And when we use words like addiction or hijacking the brain, we are teaching people that they are powerless, that these things control us. And that is, in no uncertain terms, 100% pure bullshit. It is not true. And I'm telling you this as an industry insider, not a professor who has never built products before. As an industry insider, I will tell you these techniques are good. They are effective on the margins at helping people do things they want to do, and for lack of good design, previously haven't done. But that doesn't mean people are puppets on a string. It does not mean that we can get people to do anything they want. It does not mean that we are idiots. You can fool somebody a few times, but eventually, if you sell them a product or service that hurts them, guess what? They taper back or they use your competition. And so that's what we're finding people are doing as we speak. The human species is amazing in its ability to do two things. We can adapt our behavior and we can adopt new tools to fix the bad aspect of the last generation of technology. So let me just be very clear. I'm not a tech apologist. There are a lot of things that tech companies are doing wrong. They need to be held accountable for their monopoly status, their use of data inappropriately, lots of things that I think we should understand and hold these companies to account for. But when it comes to this particular topic, that technology is addictive and hijacking our brains, it's rubbish. It's promoted by people who have an agenda. It's promoted by publications, ironically enough, who are making money the same exact way that these companies do, selling attention. Right? These are attention merchants, just like Facebook and YouTube, the New York Times, or a publication online also sells eyeballs. And guess what? Fear sells. And it's nothing new. It's a tried and true tactic to get attention, to tell you that technology is melting your brain. Today, it's Facebook and video games. Before that, it was television. Before that, it was comic books, the pinball machine, the novel, the written word, for God's sakes. All of these things were supposed to melt our minds. And literally, Socrates said that the written word will enfeeble men's minds. But you know what? the human species adapts and adopts. I am very optimistic when it comes to our future, if we know what to do. I will admit, I will definitely concede that if you don't know what to do in this day and age, they're going to get you. No doubt about it. They understand what makes you click and what makes you tick better than you understand yourself. But the antidote to impulsiveness, the antidote to all of these addictive and hijacking algorithms that are going to make you do all this terrible stuff, the antidote to impulsiveness is forethought. If you know what to do, you are way more powerful than these companies will ever be.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
So, you know, it's funny, I didn't want to get here first, but one of, we literally just, you know, at, today when we're talking, just aired a new conversation with Cal. And, you know, I have found that a lot of his ideas have been very valuable for me personally as somebody who struggles with this challenge, right? And found, I think that the thing that struck me most, and I wonder how you think about this as a father, was as somebody who struggled with depression and anxiety, like extended periods of time away from this stuff did really help immensely in terms of a lot of the things that, you know, we find are causing problems, particularly like in a younger generation, right? Where you're seeing, you know, sort of these rises of, you know, like anxiety, depression, mental health issues. And so, you know, I wonder how you think about that, because I know you did actually write about children in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole section on the book on how to raise indistractable kids. And, you know, again, I want to make sure I'm very, very clear here. If a product or service is not serving you, I want you to find ways to stop using it or moderate the use of that product or service. Okay, I'm not an advocate for using any of these products, just like I'm not an advocate for using or for watching television or reading the news or watching television. Any of these things can be distractions. Work can be a distraction. The problem is we need to go deeper. And again, I'm certainly not criticizing any particular author's work, but I think that on the whole, there's a widening gap between what the academic literature says and what the self-help community says. Mm-hmm. We've been told that the solution is a digital detox. It's a 30-day program. Get rid of it. That's bad advice. And the reason it's bad advice is for the same reason that I learned when I used to be clinically obese. Uh-huh. And I would continually go every few months on some fad diet. Okay, no junk food for 30 days. Or, you know, I'm just going to drink green tea and vinegar or whatever it was. Some stupid fad diet that I used to do again and again and again. And I, of course, you know what happens on day 31.
Yeah.
You make up for lost time. You eat everything you could possibly see. That's why these diets don't work.
Yeah.
And everything we've been told to date is pointing the finger at the tools of distraction, at what's called the proximate cause, not the root cause. Mm-hmm. And that's what Indistractable starts with. I mean, if there's one big lesson for the book, it's look for the root cause, not the proximate cause.
Yeah.
And it's only by understanding why we get distracted. And the definition of distraction, for me, is much bigger than just tech distraction. The Indistractable is not just about tech distraction.
Yeah.
We have to understand the difference. We have to define the word, first of all. As I mentioned earlier, words really, really matter. So in order to understand what we mean by distraction, we have to understand what distraction is not. So the opposite of distraction is not focus. The opposite of distraction is traction. Mm. Traction is any action that you take that moves you towards what you want to do, anything you do with intent. The opposite of traction is distraction. They both come from the same Latin root, trahere, which means to pull. So traction pulls you towards what you want. Uh-huh. Distraction pulls you away from what you want.
Yeah.
It's really about intent. It's about what you plan to do. And the reason this is such an important distinction is twofold. One, it reminds us, you notice both words end in the same word. They both end in action. Traction and distraction end in the word action, meaning these are things that we do, not things that happen to us. Second, it's important to realize that the only way you can define distraction is by understanding what you got distracted from. And so I don't make any kind of value judgment, right? Yeah. I don't say that video games are somehow morally inferior to watching a football game. What's the difference? There is no difference. But why is everybody obsessed with what video games and Facebook are doing to our brains? And we've forgotten about what television or too much, you know, too many reading books or whatever the distraction might be. It's not about the tool. It's about why we use the tool. So if you want to watch a football game or play Candy Crush or scroll YouTube or scroll Instagram or watch YouTube videos, great. I'm not going to tell you not to. What I advise is do it with intent. That's what being indistractable is about. It's about striving to do what it is you say you're going to do. It's about living with personal integrity. And if we just keep it surface level, especially with your question around kids, if we just keep it surface level, the danger is that we fool ourselves. Look, as a parent of a 10-year-old, I want nothing more than an excuse that I can blame my kids' bad behavior on. It's a sugar high. It's hormones when they're teenagers. It's whatever, 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 whatever. Parents have always been doing this crap. And today, it's TikTok and Instagram. Uh-huh. And this blinds us to what's really going on. Our kids are suffering. We need to ask ourselves, why are they turning to distraction? As we need to ask ourselves, why are we doing things we know aren't good for us, right? That's the real question, the deeper why.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate it. It's funny, like as I'm sitting here listening to you, my thought is, I'm like, I should just get you and Cal together on a podcast and have you guys debate it.
We should
while I moderate it.
I'd be happy.
I think that would be a fascinating conversation. I will send this to him and we'll ask him if he'd be willing to, because I think he would. I think he's open-minded enough that he would actually be willing to do that.
And by the way, look, again, like we reasonable people can disagree. What we agree on is the problem. The problem of distraction is a real problem out there. I think where we differ is the source of the problem. I think a lot of other folks focus on the proximate cause. I think that's very dangerous. I think we need to figure out the root cause.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, speaking of which, I mean, you basically talk about these four factors that make any satisfaction we get temporary, right? Which is boredom, our negativity bias, rumination, and hedonic adaptation. So how does that play into all this idea of distraction?
Yeah, I make the case that our species is not designed for satisfaction. And that's important to know. Because in the personal development, self-help, woo-woo community, we're somehow told that we're supposed to be happy all the time. And that's that's messed up because it is not true. We are not supposed to be satisfied. The few members of our of Homo sapiens, if they ever existed, who were ever satisfied with life, are dead because they were killed by the tribe that we descended from, who is never satisfied. And that lack of satisfaction is not necessarily a bad thing. Remember that wanting, that striving, that craving, this is what helped our species develop breakthroughs in medicine, helped us overturn despots, helped us reach for the stars. That's our natural state, is to constantly want more. Now, we can use it to our advantage. We can make the world better, or we can let it get the best of us. But we have to start with this realization that there's nothing wrong with being dissatisfied, with feeling these cognitive quirks, what I call these internal triggers of discomfort. It is part of being a human being. And the more it turns out, the more we tell ourselves that we shouldn't be feeling these things, that we should stuff down these emotions, that they're not natural, the worse off we are. We begin this rumination cycle where we think there's something wrong with us. And that becomes very, very unhealthy.
Mm, wow. So you mentioned one other thing. You said by reimagining an uncomfortable trigger, we can disarm it. What did you mean by that? And you know, one, how do people identify what an uncomfortable trigger is and the behavior that it leads to?
Yeah. So let's start with really first principles here. So the key question in the book is, why do we get distracted? But let's you know, first of all, I think that's a really interesting question to kind of inspire that curiosity in everyone listening. Like, to me, this was a really, really good question. By the way, it's a question that Aristotle and Socrates debated 2,500 years ago. They called it akrasia, this tendency that we have to do things against our better interests. And they were trying to figure out, why do we do that? And if we think to ourselves, you know, the truth is, there is not a knowledge gap in people's minds today. People basically know what to do. We all know if you want to be healthy, eat right and exercise. If you want to have good relationships, be fully present with people you care about. If you want to be great at your job, do the goddamn work, right? It's not rocket science. And yet we buy book after book and listen to guru after guru because we think they're going to tell us a magic secret. There is no magic secret. The only thing we need to know is not what to do. We already know what to do. What we need is to figure out, why don't we do the things we know we should? Why do we get distracted? Why do we sit down at our desk and we say to ourselves, okay, I'm going to work on that big project. And yet we check email or Slack channels. We say to ourselves, I'm going to go out to dinner with my friends because my friends are important to me. And we start checking our phones. We say we're going to work out, but we don't. We do something else. Why? That's the big question of this book. And if we can solve that, wouldn't that be a superpower? Like, what could we be capable of if we did everything we said we would do? So that's the big question of the book. So to answer that question, we have to answer, why do we get distracted? But let's go a step deeper. First principles. Why do we do anything? What's the nature of motivation? Most people will tell you it's Freud's pleasure principle. Freud said that everything is in the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. Jeremy Bentham said something similar. It's all about pursuit of pleasure, avoidance of pain, carrots and sticks. Wrong. Not true. It's not about the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. It turns out, neurologically speaking, it's pain all the way down. Even the pursuit of pleasure, wanting, craving a positive outcome, is itself uncomfortable. It feels destabilizing. This is called the homeostatic response. We feel it physiologically all the time, right? If you're cold, you put on a jacket. If you're hot, you take it off. If you feel hungry, you feel hunger pangs. That doesn't feel good, so you eat. So the brain prompts us to action when it feels physiological discomfort, okay? The same principle occurs when it comes to psychological discomfort. When you feel lonely, we check Facebook. When you are uncertain, you Google. When you are bored, you check Reddit or a podcast or the news or sports scores, whatever. Lots of products and services cater to these uncomfortable internal triggers, these uncomfortable emotional states. So what this means, if all behavior is spurred by a desire to escape discomfort. That means that time management is pain management. And this is where most books, every book that I've read on this topic, falls short, is that we don't get to the root cause. The root cause of all our behavior is the desire to escape discomfort. So why aren't we dealing with those root causes? And there's only two ways to deal with those root causes. Either you fix the source of discomfort, you figure out what's causing the pain in your life. And this is absolutely critical when it comes to helping other people like our kids, but also for ourselves. The number one cause of these internal triggers in our life for most people is their workplace. So there's a whole section in the book where I talk about why distraction at work is a symptom of dysfunctional culture. We want to blame it on technology, but let me tell you, there is no correlation between how much technology a company uses and how distracted people feel there, because distraction is a symptom of corporate dysfunction, cultural dysfunction. And so we have to fix that source of the problem. That's just one example, but whatever it might be, whatever you're looking to escape from, whether it's with a bottle, whether it's with some other distraction, you know, working too much, watching too many sports, being on Facebook too much, whatever it might be, you have to figure out what you are trying to escape and either fix the problem or learn to cope with it. And so there are three strategies to cope with it. You can either reimagine the trigger itself, you can reimagine the task, or you can reimagine your temperament. And that there's lots of details on how to do that, but that's the basic structure for the first part.
Okay. So there's, you know, we'll talk specifically, like the funny thing that I thought of immediately was like, oh, like what about people who watch porn? Like, is that also just fall into this category? And, you know, like, can you, it made me think about, you know, so all of the research that has come out about this was like, oh yeah, this is terrible for you. It screws up your relationships. It's like frying your brain. And so porn is a product that gets people hooked. And I wonder how you think about that.
So any analgesic can become addictive. Mm. Anything that solves pain can be addictive to someone. Porn, alcohol, even cigarettes, turns out the majority of people who use these products are not addicted. Right? A lot of us have a glass of wine with dinner. Alcohol is second to nicotine and heroin, one of the most addictive substances on earth. And yet very few people are alcoholics. How can that be? How can something that's addictive not addict everyone? Well, we see this all the time. A lot of us have a glass of wine with dinner. We're not all alcoholics. A lot of us, you know, watch porn sometimes or have sex sometimes. We're not all sex addicts. And that's why this is so ridiculous to keep using this word addictive when we describe technology, because it's not nuanced. It's binary thinking. It's low fidelity thinking by people who are too lazy to think this through or don't know the facts about addiction. Lots of products can addict someone and not addict everyone. So I used to say, when I didn't understand how this really worked, I used to say that the internet is the cigarette of the century. This was Ian Bogos first said this, and I don't say that anymore. Because the technology is not like cigarettes. Cigarettes have nicotine in them, which cross the blood-brain barrier and have an effect on the prefrontal cortex of the brain. And they affect decision-making in some form. That's not what happens with Facebook or our iPhones. We're not injecting Instagram. We're not freebasing Facebook. These are behaviors, right? So we have to keep this in perspective. Yeah. Technology is not like cigarettes. If anything, technology is like cannabis. Why do I say that? We know that THC, the psychotropic substance in cannabis, is not addictive, not in the same way that heroin or nicotine are. They're not addictive. And yet, how is it then that 9% of people who use cannabis have a cannabis use disorder? How can that be? There's nothing addictive about it. And it's the same way with technology, that everything that solves pain, any analgesic, can become addictive to a certain type of person. So addiction is never about the substance. It's the confluence of three factors, right? Remember, nobody steps on a heroin needle and becomes an addict. That's not how it works. Addicts always have backstories every time. Addiction is the confluence of three things: a person with a predilection for addiction, a product that certainly plays a role, and the pain the person is going through. The person, the product, and the pain. If you take one of those things out, people lose their addictions. right? If they learn to cope with their discomfort in a healthier manner, if they deal with what's going on in their life, this is what trauma-based therapy is all about. You know, people are using substances to get out of their heads, to escape an uncomfortable reality. That's the seat of all addiction. There's much more to this. Mm-hmm. And so this is why it's so harmful. It's disrespectful for people who have a pathology to say that all these things are addicting all of us. It's utter nonsense. And more than that, worse off, it teaches the 99% of us, 95 to 99% of us who do not have that pathology that we are somehow incapable of helping ourselves. And that's why this is so dangerous. That's why I'm so passionate about this. Because when we let people promote this myth that technology is addictive and it's hijacking our brains, it becomes true. It's called learned helplessness. People act accordingly. Mm. They say, well, there's nothing I can do. The big bad algorithms at the big bad technology companies are doing it to me. So those crazy kids, they just, you know, they're all addicted. There's nothing we can do. And there's nothing I can do because, you know, they've got me too. And so this is what happens, even subconsciously. This is what happens in our minds and why this is so pernicious and dangerous.
Yeah, it's funny because now I'm thinking I need to just get you, Stephen Kotler, and Cal Newport all together, like in a panel online and just invite people to come and, you know, talk about
that. Well, if they've got two on their side, then I need some backup.
Fair so enough.
I want you to invite Johan Hari. Johan Hari wrote a fantastic book called Lost Connections.
Yeah, I read
which
that.
Really,
I've been wanting to get him on the show. Like
he is wonderful, and he says it so well. He says the opposite of addiction is not sobriety; it's connection. Because what people turn to when they are in pain is something to take their mind off of that pain. Yeah. That's the nature of addiction. And I'll give you others. Mark Lewis is a neuroscientist who was a former addict himself. I mean, we've been fed this bill of lies back from the 1980s that, you know, just say no and drugs are bad. And it's not about that. It's so ironic, too, that in this time when we want to legalize cannabis, we want to legislate these technologies. But we're using the same outdated, incorrect point of view about what addiction really is. And it's hurting us. It's making the problem worse.
So you mentioned the sort of three things that we can do, right? One was identity. And I think the other one was around task. And I don't remember what the third one was.
The trigger.
Yeah. So it's funny because I remember that I was trying to remember whose book I had read this in when you said, you know, that what we say to ourselves is vitally important, like labeling yourself as having poor self-control actually leads to self-control. Now, I don't remember whether it was your book or Adam Alter's book where you said, you know, if you basically say there's a simple difference between somebody who says, I can't use, you know, Facebook or Instagram whenever, or you say, I don't. And the difference is basically, okay, I don't use this thing on weekends. He said, you're much more likely to be the person who doesn't. And I couldn't remember which of the two books because your quote kind of was a mirror of that as well. Mm.
Yeah, so the research has been out for a while. It's pretty fascinating. Actually, you jumped ahead a little bit. So there's just to kind of fill people in for the steps that we pass because it's important that we go in order here because if you jump ahead to some of these techniques, they can actually backfire. So there's actually a danger to some of these techniques and people use them, the right techniques at the wrong time. And they actually find themselves worse off because of it. So just to kind of, you know, paint the picture of what it takes to be indistractable, it takes four steps. It takes mastering the internal triggers, which is all about, you know, gaining control of learning to cope with these uncomfortable emotional states or fixing the source of the problem. The second step is to make time for traction, which we didn't talk about yet, but that's a critically important step is to make time for traction. And again, if how you want to spend your time is with, you know, football or Candy Crush or whatever, that's great. As long as you make time to live out your values, critically important and something that the vast majority of people do not do in their day-to-day lives. And then they complain about being distracted when they didn't know what they got distracted from. The third step is to hack back external triggers. So this is what, you know, people typically think of when they think about, you know, getting control of their technology. It's about turning off notifications, et cetera. But what I think a lot of people miss is that the world is full of all kinds of non-tech distractions. So I talk about these eight different environments that that send us external triggers, these pings, dings, and rings that take us off track. So of course, there's the usual suspects of your computer and your cell phone, but also the biggest culprit for most people is the open floor plan office. A colleague stopping by your desk and saying, hey, what's up? Let's chit chat. That can be a distraction if that's not what you plan to do with your time. And this leads to worse results. But of course, we don't talk about that because it's big bad technology that's doing it to us when there's some, you know, very pernicious sources of distraction that we've avoided, that we've been blindsided by. Meetings, for God's sakes. Oh my God, how many meetings are pure, utter distraction? So I tell you how to hack back external triggers in all these contexts. And then the last step, which you just mentioned a technique from, is about preventing distraction with pacts. And so this is where I have to raise a big caution warning sign that if you do this prematurely, if you try and use these pre-commitments, these pacts, which can be very effective, but only if done after you do the other three steps. So this is kind of the heavy artillery that if you use these prematurely, if you haven't mastered the internal triggers, if you haven't made time for traction, if you haven't hacked back the external triggers, and you jump straight to the preventing distraction with pacts, it's going to backfire. But that being said, let's say you've done all the other three. You can make three type of pacts. The three types of pacts are an effort pact, a price pact, and an identity pact. An effort pact is when we put some bit of friction, something in our way that prevents us from doing something we don't want to do. So for example, in my household, we were personal to start the discussion. I'll kind of end the discussion with something pretty personal, my sex life. My wife and I, as we mentioned, you know, we've been married for almost 20 years. A while ago, before I learned these techniques to become indistractable, our sex life was really suffering because we were staying up later and later every night on our computers, on our phones. And so we used a pact, an effort pact. We went to the hardware store. We bought a $10 outlet timer and we plugged it into our wall and we plugged in our devices into that timer. So every night at 10 p.m., my computer, my monitor, my router all shuts off. Now, if I really wanted to, I could unplug and replug and fix it, right? So that it's still on. But now I've inserted a bit of effort so that I don't do what I don't want to do, right? So I don't get distracted. So I don't do something that I'm doing without intent. So that's an effort pact. A price pact is when you have some kind of cost, and we're a little bit running out of time, but there's a lot more to be said about price pacts. Yeah. But then finally, and what you alluded to, is this identity pact, which to me was the most interesting and most surprising category of the three. An identity pact is when we use our self-image to prevent us doing something we don't want to do. And so we're coming full circle here back to religion, because a lot of this research comes from organized religion, because there's this interesting phenomenon that adherents of faith, you know, the people who are real followers, somehow they don't have to expend a lot of self-control, a lot of willpower when they don't do things that many other people do. So for example, a devout Muslim doesn't ask themselves, I wonder if I should have a beer today. No, they are a devout Muslim. They don't drink alcohol. An Orthodox Jew doesn't say, should I have that BLT today? Should I have that bacon or not? No, they're an Orthodox Jew. It's something they do not do. So there's a joke that goes, how do you know someone's a vegetarian? Don't worry, they'll tell you, right? So our identity, by the way, I was a vegetarian for 5 years, so I'm poking fun at myself here as well. But I can tell you that while I was a vegetarian, not eating meat was no big deal because I was a vegetarian. Uh-huh. Vegetarians don't eat meat. It was part of my identity. So this leads us to why I call the book Indistractable. Yeah. That's the new moniker. That's what we can call ourselves, right? If we don't return messages instantly, right? And your friends say, hey, how come you didn't text me right back? Yeah. I'm indistractable. When you use these techniques, I have every copy of the book comes with a screen sign that you can put on your monitor at work to tell people you're indistractable, right? I wear a t-shirt many days when I don't feel like going to the gym. I wear the shirt that says indistractable across my chest to remind me I am indistractable. It's part of who I am, because it turns out, and this is one thing you saw in the book, this is not personal anecdote. This is not, it worked for me, it's going to work for everybody. Everything in the book is backed by peer review research. And so this technique that you mentioned earlier of being the kind of person who says I don't versus I can't, and tying it to identity, is an incredibly powerful way to make sure we don't get distracted.
Yeah. So I know you got to get going. I mean, this has been packed with nuggets, and I recommend anybody who's listening to buy the book, because there's a lot of really thought-provoking insight, but I think I got so much more just from this conversation. There's one thing I wanted to have you tell our listeners about, because I remember I went and looked for it, and in the spirit of confessional, I mean, like, I smoke my fair share of cannabis, like, and every now and then I use, the tobacco from it to roll, spliffs, but sometimes it'll be like, early morning, tempted to roll it, just with tobacco, not because, I want to get high. And you mentioned this thing called the kitchen safe.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So the kitchen safe, you might remember this from, it was on an episode of Shark Tank. So the kitchen safe is an example of an effort pact. And again, this is the heavy artillery. This is something we have to do after we've done the other three steps. But the kitchen safe is basically this little plastic box. You can buy it on Amazon. I think they changed the name. Now it's called K-Safe. Basically, you whatever you put into the K-Safe, it could be a muffin, it could be a donut, it could be a spiff, whatever it is that you don't want access to, you put it inside and you set a timer for how long you want to be locked out of getting access to it. So this is an effort pact, because what you're doing is you're making a pre-commitment. Remember, maybe if there's one thing I want everyone to write down, it's that the antidote to impulsiveness is forethought. So what you're doing is thinking ahead, right? This is one thing that our species does better than any other animal on earth. We can predict the future. So predicting ahead, I'm going to get tempted. I'm going to get potentially distracted. I'm going to take a step now to prevent me from doing something I don't want to do later. You put whatever it is you don't want access to inside the case safe. You put on the lid, you set the timer, and it doesn't let you have access to that thing for a set period of time. Now, you could take a hammer and you could bash it open, right?
But and that'd be expensive $60 to get your
chocolate. So that's an effort pact. You put a bit of friction, a bit of effort between what it is you don't want to do.
Mm. Wow. Wow. This has been amazing. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think it is the desire to want to have one's mind changed. That's something that, you know, Carol Dweck calls the growth mindset. I think that is such a beautiful attribute. And I love Carol Dweck's research into this. She wrote a great book on it as well. But this idea that, you know, the idea of wanting to have your world change, wanting your apple cart to be turned over, I love that sensation. And I love to give it to other people. Sometimes people don't always want to have their minds changed, but that to me is a huge compliment when someone can spend the time with me to explain something they've researched deeply or thought about deeply and change my mind. That is something I really respect in another person. Of course, doing it, you know, not in a way that is disagreeable or is aggressive or based on kind of any kind of animosity, but doing it in a respectful manner, attempting to change someone's mind thoughtfully is an incredibly beautiful trait.
Amazing. Where can people find out more about you, your work, the book, and everything else that you're up to?
Sure. Yeah, thanks. So my blog is at nearandfar.com. Near is spelled a little different. It's spelled like my first name, N-I-R. So nearandfar.com, N-I-R-andfar.com. And then my first book is called Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. My next book is called Indistractable. And that you can find out more about Indistractable at indistractable.com. So it's N-I-N-Distractable, indistractable.com.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Transitioning to a decarbonized economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organization and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch. The skills that are essential for standing out and thriving, no matter how much technology evolved. We're talking about real differentiators here, like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.